Partly sunny skies at 77 degrees. Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. You know, sometimes coming up with an idea is easy, but execution is not. And sometimes the idea spawns into a global endeavor. In 1973, Habitat for Humanity was actually an idea conceptualized on the grounds of a community farm just outside of Americus, Georgia. The idea? Simple. Volunteers would build decent, affordable homes at no profit for low-income households. Well, Habitat for Humanity International was actually officially founded in 1976. As we continue our year-long series on affordable housing, we turn to Atlanta Habitat. And Lisa Gordon is president and CEO of one of the largest local affiliates in the U.S., and she joins me now in studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
I was going to save this question for later in the script, but I think I'm going to start with this question because I've asked everybody this question. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
What should affordable housing look like?
I think to me, affordable housing should look like a community where you want to live. So independent of who you are and what you make, everybody wants a decent place to live. They want green space. They want to see their kids riding bikes. They want to be in a neighborhood where I grew up with my parents. My mom was a nurse. My dad was a post office worker. And we had a great community, but it was affordable. It was not affluent or high end. So I think, to me, the vision is a safe, decent place where you see people engaging in that community.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Long Island, New York.
So you saw this was the sort of the area of what you feel affordable housing should, it's a template for what affordable housing should look like.
I think so, and I think working at Habitat, we have a great model of success, and if you look around the country, there's different models of affordable housing, but I think you really want a community that is affordable on paper, but if you walk through the community, you say, this is a nice place, I'd like to live here.
When you look around Atlanta, the Atlanta area, do you see a lot of that?
I see some of it in varying degrees, and you may see in even a challenged neighborhood a block, and that block looks great. Mm-hmm. And you're like, this whole neighborhood used to look like this block. And so I think there are plenty of neighborhoods that have great bones, beautiful historical homes, nice lots, nice layout, sidewalks. And you could tell that those communities were once vibrant. Mm-hmm. And the disinvestment is what's left them to be, you know, a challenged neighborhood, a neighborhood where people don't want to live.
I love that phrasing, great bones. And we're going to talk about neighborhoods in just a second. But let's back up a little bit because Atlanta Habitat was actually formed in 1983. How many homes has the organization built? Any ideas?
Yes, the Atlanta Habitat's built about 1,400 homes since 1983. We build annually 50 homes, and we've expanded our programs now to where we do a repair program. And so we're doing about 40 repairs because back to making those neighborhoods look good, there's people in those neighborhoods that need mm-hmm. help, that they don't get it and they can't afford it, but it's what they need for those communities to thrive.
Before we get deep into expanding the mission, which you just sort of hit on, I want to go over how these homes are built. So let's start from the beginning. Who's eligible to apply for assistance here?
Most Habitat homeowners need to be about 30% to 80% of the average median income. That's a fancy way of saying someone who makes between $20,000 and $30,000 a year with one to four people in the household is able to be eligible for one of our homes.
And is the location already predetermined, or are there areas that you can say, hey, you've been approved, but here's the area that we can get your home?
Well, what we do in our program is we have lots. So we have an inventory of lots, mm-hmm. and each person, they tell us the areas where they would like to live, and we identify three lots in those communities, and they usually select one. So anywhere in the city of Atlanta, most communities, we have lots available, and that's how the selection process goes.
And what's the typical design of the home? Is it ranch style, single family style, duplex?
It's a ranch, single family. It's either a three-bedroom or four-bedroom on a nice lot. And we also have a new two-story model that we are piloting as soon as we can get a good homeowner for it, so that we'll have two-story ranch
homes.
So
you have
as well.
Something available and you're waiting for a good homeowner?
That's right. We sure are.
Are the building materials, are they donated?
The materials are donated, but we also purchase materials when some of them are at discounts. But our homes are more like a Craftsman model. And so it's a nice urban cottage or very nice homes. And we've updated our designs as well. So now we have some wraparound porches. We have different roof packages. And so we've really tried to make our homes look like the best home on the block.
Do you think there's a perception that people have about Habitat for Humanity in terms of who the applicants are and who's taking advantage or who's benefiting from these homes?
I think the biggest misperception is that we give homes away free and that homeowners don't work and earn their homes and pay the mortgage. They have a mortgage. It's zero interest because we use volunteers and sponsors to help us defray the cost and to allow it to be affordable. But I think that's the biggest misconception. So if someone thinks you got something for free, then they think you don't have the ability to pay for it. Once people are educated about what we do, we find that people are like, oh, they're just like me.
Is that also part of your mission in terms of educating or having to keep educating the community about Habitat for Humanity and particularly the Atlanta region here as well?
Yes, I think one of the things that has happened, and this is across the country, across the world, Habitat has a brand and people know Habitat is giving houses to people, but it's really helping people have accessibility to houses through the program. So continuous education is important, but also because we're doing different things now. The market looks different.
How long does it typically take to construct the home, install all the appliances, and the family is ready to move in?
In our program, it takes 8 Saturdays to build a home with volunteers. We use about 30 to 40
volunteers. 8 Saturdays?
Yes. Yes.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So the home is ready in 8 Saturdays, and the family usually moves in about 3 or 4 weeks after that. We put the appliances in right when they're ready to move in.
You know, you came aboard in 2015, and you came aboard to an organization that had a basic mission. We've been talking about this. But you see yourself is sort of leading, and I'm sure other habitats across the nation may be doing this, but you've been talking about expanding the mission of the Atlanta affiliate. What does that look like when you're talking about expanding the mission?
I think it's interesting. When I joined Habitat, they're doing great work. So already well-established organizations. But what I noticed being out at a build is we just drove by blight. And we had a great home for our homeowner, but there was nothing else happening on that block. And I wondered to myself, if we did nothing else but get the new home for our homeowner, what else would happen in that community? Mm-hmm. And so we started with a Build the Block program, where we're looking at expanding the services. So not only do we do new homes, we do critical repairs, and we do other programs, community cleanups, and we try to build that block. If that block looks better, we find that neighbors that are not even in our program start cleaning up their houses. And we feel like that can have a ripple effect in that neighborhood.
So you're talking about transforming entire neighborhoods.
Absolutely. So our new mission is that we'll be a catalyst for neighborhood revitalization. So we're not doing all of the neighborhood revitalization, but what the work we're doing could be catalytic, and that we could work with partners, we could look at innovative development, we could educate people, and we can work together as a community to try to make those communities transform.
Can you give an example of where you all are doing this already?
We actually are doing it in Dixie Hills, where we have a subdivision. That neighborhood is near Douglas High School. Mm-hmm. And what we found is there was a block driving up to our subdivision that was just blighted. And so when we started the expanded mission, that block really looked bad. And so it's kind of like, well, let's look the other way when we turn into this beautiful neighborhood. But that's what we shouldn't do. We should invest. And so we've done 3 community cleanups on that block. We have done critical repair for 3 or 4 homeowners. These are elderly. Our first homeowners were, the husband was 92 and the wife was 88. They lived in the neighborhood for 40 years. And so we were able to provide assistance where it was needed. And now when you drive up that block, it looks great. And then we've also built about 3 or 4 new homes on that block. So now where that block used to be a block of blight, it's really a block of transformation. And then what we've noticed is that other homeowners not in our program have cleaned up their houses. So just that halo effect of seeing your house look as good as the rest of the houses on the blocks really made a difference.
And I imagine the property values have increased as well, maybe?
I think they may have. There's some other blight in that community, but we're working on it. The goal, though, is to, if the property values go up, we don't want them to go up to get people out of those neighborhoods.
Sure.
We want people to stay. And so that's why the program's focused on retention and focused on building where there's a need.
The voice you hear is Lisa Gordon. She's president and CEO of Atlanta Habitat for Humanity. And we're talking about not just affordable housing, because we've been talking about it all year long, but constructing affordable housing. since this series began, we've been asking that question, what affordable housing should look like. And everyone who's come in and sat in that chair or even around this studio table have all said that it takes either a holistic approach or a collaborative approach from lawmakers and city officials and civic leaders and community leaders. How do you see Atlanta Habitat fitting into that collaborative in terms of creating and sustaining affordable housing in the Atlanta area?
I think we are one of the few organizations that has a long-term approach to affordable housing, and so most of our solutions have been sustainable over time. In my mind, we provide homeownership options for our homeowners, community revitalization, as well as we provide sustainability. So on the west side is a great example. They only have about, I think it's 499 homeowners. Mm-hmm. Of that number, 50 of them are Habitat homeowners. They've been in their homes for 10 or 20 years. We also have 20 lots over there. So that means, you know, as that neighborhood transforms, we have more opportunities to build affordable. But the issue we've had is there's not been any people that wanted to live in this neighborhood till last year.
And that's because of the stadium.
And that's because of the investment that's coming in, right?
Because of the stadium.
Right. Well, that's a catalyst, right? Yeah. The stadium is a catalyst for that. But I think Habitat is one of the few groups that provides the people solution and the infrastructure solution. So we work on the people, financial literacy, education of home ownership, maintenance, long-term sustainability for the family. So not only are they able to live in that house, pay their mortgage, but they're able to pay it off.
And you all have this focus on the West Side, and we'll stay with that for a moment, and you call it a West Side Renaissance. And I think when people think about the West Side, we know of its historic significance to this city. And then we know about the transformation that it went through, particularly after the 60s and the 70s and so on. Can the West Side get back to that golden era, but at the same time, Ms. Gordon, the people who've been there, the people who have made it the West Side, will they be able to stay there, you think?
Well, I think it depends on how the solutions are crafted. So I think there's a huge effort to do community retention, and there's a committee, a steering committee that's working on that. I'm working on that with that group. And so I think everyone is aware of that. But I think the biggest issue that people have to confront is that a good 60% of the neighborhood's vacant. So if everybody stayed.
I mean, right now.
Right now, yes. Because if you go down to any block, you'll see 10 homes. You probably see four of them filled. Based on the statistics of home ownership, probably one of the people of the four filled, it actually owns that home. So if you think about it, on that block, if the four people that are there today, and there's plenty of blocks you can ride down and you'll see this as an example. If those four people stayed, whether the renters or homeowners, and six new people come and populate that block, to the four people that were there, it's going to feel like this is not my block anymore. This mm-hmm. is not my neighborhood. So I think there's got to be, how do we integrate the old and the historic with the new people that will kind of be filling up the vacant lots in addition to retaining those people? So that's one of the issues that doesn't get talked about as much, but there's lots of vacant property on the West Side.
Do you think people know this?
I think they do intuitively, but it's two different issues. So one is the neighborhood's half vacant, right? Mm-hmm. So if you just backfill the neighborhood, it's going to feel different. And with new people that don't have the history, your voice might not be the same as it was when there's only four people on the block. So there's one neighbor who's very vocal, who's a champion for change mm-hmm. in the neighborhood. So everybody's listening to that person. When the other six people move into the neighborhood, now there's 10 people. Is that person's voice still heard, or are other voices heard?
Absolutely. And when we talk about equity in terms of affordable housing throughout the city of Atlanta, depending on who you ask, it's slowly happening, and some will say, no, it's still stagnant from even pre-recession. Part of the conversation is the Beltline and what it's going to do, or what it should do, or what it was supposed to do. And there's been a leadership change in the Beltline. Now, some media reports say leadership of the development has been failing, Lisa Gordon, in terms of its promise to include affordable housing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have to say, full disclosure, I worked at the Beltline mm-hmm. From 2010 to 2015. So as part of the conversations around affordable housing and what solutions need to be put in place. But I think the key issue was, in my mind, dollars are needed to get land. If you don't have the land, you can't ensure that affordable housing occurs. And during the time when land was cheap, during the recession, and when there was opportunities to acquire land, there was no money to get the land. So without the land, you can't get affordable housing. So all the solutions at that time were, we'll give incentives to developers and we'll ask them to build a percentage.
Which was what, 15 to 20% maybe?
Again, but then the developers, during the recession, nobody was building. And then when the recession was over, the developers are like, I need to make up for the past 3-4 years. So I won't take your incentives. I'll just build, get my own capital financing, and I'll build. And then if the Beltline doesn't have any land, their own self, how can they direct that affordable housing? They've done some projects, and I think the intent was there. But there's also an issue with if people can voluntarily opt in or opt out to affordable housing, then you're waiting for the goodwill of the developers to make that happen.
Despite that there was this promise that there would be thousands of affordable housing units.
I think there was a promise that there would be thousands of units, and that original estimate was based on also a market number of housing being very high. So it's something like 28,000 units of market rate, and then 20% of that is how you got to 5,600. So a lot of people don't know that. They just say, you're supposed to build 5,600. But a better barometer is if there was supposed to be 28,000 and you're supposed to build 5,600, what do you have today? And then what is the 20% of what you have today? Because that would be more accurate barometer, and it would take into account what happened during the recession.
Can you all fill some of that void that obviously is, it appears is going to be left in terms of affordable housing along the Beltline area? I know you all look at lots, but are some of those lots, I mean, the West End is going to be connected to the Beltline. So can you guys come in and
We can build anywhere that we have a lot. So certainly we can be part of the solution to getting more housing. But again, I think some of that land has already been acquired, and unfortunately it's been acquired by investors. And so it's really hard when you try to get land that somebody got for, you know, less than a couple $1,000s or maybe a couple $100s, and they want 10 times the market value of its best use. So they're coming to you with these exorbitant prices, and land is what drives affordability. And even in our program, there's some land that we would love to build in certain areas, but we can't afford the land.
Like what?
Like what areas?
Yeah, like what areas?
I mean, any of the areas that are trending today, I would say any of the neighborhoods that would be trending, we wouldn't be able to buy land in those neighborhoods. So a good example is Cabbage Town. We built in Cabbage Town over 20 years ago. And those homes that we built 10, 20 years ago, those homes are going for 3-4 times what we built them for. And those homeowners are under enormous amount of pressure to sell their homes.
Wow.
And it would be a huge payday for them because now it's worth 3-5 times the value.
And you can't blame them if they choose to.
And that's the other issue. Sometimes people choose to take advantage of wealth building and financial opportunities.
You all have a focus on the West Side as we wrap up. Are there any other areas? I think of what's happening with the Pittsburgh neighborhood, and there's a lot of attention that needs to happen to that community. It's historic as it is as well. What do you see Atlanta Habitat in terms of the future and trying to get into those areas as well? And maybe not necessarily lots, but you mentioned rehabilitating and, you know, upgrading some of those units that are already there. That's a neighborhood that needs a lot of attention.
Pittsburgh has been on my radar for many, many years, and it's definitely a neighborhood that needs investment, it needs homes, and it needs people. And I think one of the issues is you have to be really careful when you do renovation. Somebody has to want that house. In our program, we build it or we renovate it once somebody says, I want to live there. Because we can't afford to build or renovate 10 homes and then wait for people that want to build there.
But you just talked about a few moments ago how you all can be a catalyst for change in the neighborhood. So maybe that's what it is.
We can be, as long as we can find the people that can fill those homes.
Lisa Gordon is president and CEO of Atlanta Habitat. Thank you for coming in and being a part of this ongoing series on affordable housing.
Thank you so much for the invitation to talk about an issue that I'm very passionate about.
Eight Saturdays and get a house up there.
Come and build with us on the women's build.
Really? As a women's build?
Yes.
I'm enlisting everybody on the Closer Look team to do that. They're looking at me like, Rose, but we'll be there.
Thank you.
Support for WABE comes from Innovation Arts and Entertainment. An Evening with David Sedaris at the Fox Theater, author, humorist, and contributor to This American Life. An evening of readings, book signing, and Q&A. Sunday, October 22nd. Tickets at foxtheater.org. The Atlanta Board of Education welcomes input from students, parents, staff, and the community. The next community meeting is Tuesday, September 5th at 6 p.m. in the Atlanta Public School Center for Learning and Leadership Auditorium, 130 Trinity Avenue, Southwest Atlanta. Sign-in is from 5 to 5:50 p.m. Atlanta Public Schools, with a caring culture of trust and collaboration, every student will graduate ready for college and career.
If you missed any part of today's show, we got you. You can catch up on all the interviews you missed at wabe.org/closerlook. And let me know what you think. Tweet me at WABE Rose Scott or send an email to rose@wabe.org. This is member supported 90.1 WABE Atlanta.
My name is Will, and I live in Decatur. I would say it's like a university town, but with adults, more adults. I like that it's close to Atlanta, but it's also its own kind of town. Well, I like downtown Decatur. It's easier to walk around. It's less spread out. Not really wild about the strip mall parts of like Lawrenceville Highway and North Druid Hills. Like the traffic's really bad and I don't know how many more McDonald's we need.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our 30th anniversary retrospective, featuring interviews from our first 2 years. We'll hear a 1987 interview with Ronnie Spector of the girl group The Ronettes, and 1988 interviews with Otis Williams of The Temptations, and Ben E. King, who was a lead singer of The Drifters and had the hit Stand By Me. Join us this afternoon at 2 on 90.1 WABE.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. On Monday's program, we began conversations that deal with race, messaging, preserving history through symbols and monuments, and that's where we pick up today. But we're also going to go back. On June 17th, 9 parishioners at Mother Emanuel AME Church, this was a couple years ago, were killed by Dylan Roof, a self-avowed white supremacist. Then President Barack Obama gave the eulogy at the funeral of Clementa Pinckney, the pastor of the historic church.
We do not know whether the killer of Reverend Pinckney and 8 others knew all of this history. But he surely sensed the meaning of his violent act. It was an act that drew on a long history of bombs and arson and shots fired at churches, not random, but as a means of control, a way to terrorize and oppress. An act that he imagined would incite fear and recrimination, violence and suspicion. An act that he presumed would deepen divisions that trace back to our nation's original sin.
When President Obama talks about original sin, depending on who you ask, many thought of slavery, many talked about the Civil War. And of course, this sparked a lot of conversations about what should we do with Confederate symbolism, statues, symbols, emblems, and particularly when they hang in public spaces. And where should they hang? Here in Atlanta, it spurred action by local institutions, and the Atlanta History Center created its Confederate Monument Interpretation Guide. So join me now to talk about this guide and its role following all this conversation across the nation about what to do with Confederate or historic symbols that might be related to the Confederate. Well, I'm joined now by Sheffield Hale, President and CEO of the Atlanta History Center. Thank you so much for coming in and taking
the time. Thank you for having me.
When it comes to museums and history centers, we expect to see monuments, symbols, history, heritage, right? But when there's a tragedy like what happened in Charlottesville, and it's based on protesters who wanted to keep up a statue of Robert E. Lee, then becomes that gray area. Or do you see it as a gray area in terms of what we should do? And this is your personal opinion, what we should do about these type of symbols and monuments in public spaces. Do they deserve to be there?
I mean, I think it's a conversation that communities need to have. And it's not a one-fits-all solution, because the monuments and the communities are different. And so we began right after Charleston event, which was just horrific, trying to decide how would we deal with the Confederate monument issue. The Confederate flag, which is really the impetus there, mm-hmm. is a lot easier to deal with. That's it's a current political statement. You have to raise that every day. Mm-hmm. That's something that you put up every day. But a monument was a political statement, say in 1920 or in 1890. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you do about that? And that's sort of it's a different inquiry. So we started with this guide to help communities wrestle with that.
And this guide is based on all the monuments what monuments are included in terms of this guide?
Generally, the Confederate monuments that were created, after the war, there are two types of those monuments generally. Mm-hmm. The first type were the ones that were put up in cemeteries. They were about bereavement and loss, and those were in the early days, pre-1890. A great example of that in Atlanta would be the obelisk at Oakland Cemetery that mm-hmm. was started in 1869 and finished in 1873, and says to our Confederate dead.
And when you talk about interpretation, you are including, from a historical standpoint, why they were put up, who were they in homage to, and all of that.
Right, and what was behind it, the second phase really started in the 1890s to the 1920s and 30s. And that was a phase where they were putting these types of monuments in public spaces and courthouse squares, essentially in your face. And it's a different kind of message that was being sent.
Based on what you just said, a different kind of message that was sent, do you think some people who are proponents of keeping these monuments and statues in public spaces, do you think they missed that point in terms of what the purpose was, particularly in the 20s through the 50s, of erecting these monuments and other statues?
No, I think a lot of them do, and it's this whole history versus heritage debate. And I define heritage as history where you leave out all the bad parts, all the parts you don't want to remember. And a lot of this, these monuments were put up in the era of Jim Crow and segregation, and reflected the white supremacy of that era. And that's why they were put in front of courthouses. And that's, a equestrian statue like we have downtown of John B. Gordon on a horse, mm-hmm. that's not about loss. That's about power. And it's a different inquiry. And so our guide that we put together encouraged people to go and look at why their monuments in their particular cities were erected. Mm-hmm. What did they say at the time? Not what we say now. What did they say at the time? And then to put these monuments in context and give them a template that they could use and modify mm-hmm. that would talk about these monuments and what they left out. And it was generally they left out the most explicitly African Americans.
Mm-hmm. What's the feedback been like?
It's been good. We've had a lot of people around the country, call us and use it. It's as a conversation starter, whether or not it ends up actually being on a particular statue. The idea was give somebody the tools to take something in writing to a community event and say, should we contextualize it? And but the same arguments for contextualization, other people would argue it should remove them.
There's information on how to research the history of the monuments. There's a guide that encourages people to find out who maintains monuments in a given city and whether the city council or parks and recreation is involved. And you all wanted to include this. Why?
We thought it was up to the people who live in the communities to understand their history. We thought it was a tool for conversation. Whether or not anything actually happened to the monument, somebody locally needed to have the tools to have to start having that conversation and to do it in a manner that was productive. And we think the facts are generally helpful.
You're a guy that loves history, obviously. You know the importance of history. You know the lessons that history can teach. You know the lessons that a monument or a statue can teach. And I may ask you to come out of your role as the guy in charge of Atlanta History Center, but you've said that these conversations, the decisions should be left up to the people. But what do you think in terms of a statue of Robert E. Lee in a public space?
Again, it's hard, and it really depends. Mm-hmm. I think in some cases they can be instructive to talk about the lost cause and to talk about why those statues were put up and how people rationalized white supremacy. They can be useful. In other places, it's much more difficult to do that. And the other thing that you end up getting into arguments over is about Robert E. Lee. Was Robert E. Lee a good guy or a bad guy? Mm-hmm. That's really beside the point in most of these monuments issues, and that's really a way to go down a rabbit hole. What you really got to find, what was the purpose of the monument? Mm-hmm. Robert E. Lee was a tool. He was used on a monument to deliver a message. It's not really about Robert E. Lee. It's not about history. It's about mythology and what people in 1920 were trying to say about their place in society and about the Civil War.
Do you think then the argument of, but this is my Southern heritage, but this is part of my heritage, is it, then are you saying that that's just sort of a excuse?
I think people believe that. And part of this is, people were taught this lost cause theology, white people were, from the cradle on in their schools, the people they trusted the most, their parents and grandparents. The United Daughters of the Confederacy did a brilliant job of getting portraits of Robert E. Lee and the textbooks to explain this mythology that the war did not revolve around, did not come out of slavery, because that was extremely important in their worldview to say it wasn't about slavery, it's about states' rights and these other issues. And what when people talk about their heritage, it's really interesting. They often will say, well, this is what, the people wanted. And I'm like, well, do you realize that a majority of Southerners were not in favor of the Confederacy and were against that? And they say, well, what do you mean? Well, I say, well, 40% of Southerners were enslaved. So you can start with that. And then you add all the Southerners who were against the war, including many in Atlanta and North Georgia and lots of other places that were against the war. There was quite a diversity of opinion.
Mm-hmm. And so, I can imagine.
And so then the question is, who's a Southerner comes up? And then it gets, and I think that's really important to talk about, and whose heritage, and we need to talk about more inclusively all of our heritage and how we deal with it.
Any idea how many monuments, statues there are, not only just here in the Atlanta area, but in Georgia that were related to the Confederacy?
We believe there are about 140 in Georgia, and that probably understates it. Over 1,000 in the nation.
Wow. And the odds of all of them being removed, probably.
Right. And one of the reasons that we came up with this guide is that if they're not removed, and our position at the History Center is not one way or the other,
sure,
it's the community. But if they're not removed, we believe they should be contextualized. And we've given people tools to do that and to talk about what the real history is in a way that's non-threatening. Let's have a discussion of the history. Let's hear what people at the time said was the cause of the war. Let's say what they said when they erected the monument. What did they say? Not what did somebody at the Atlanta History Center today say.
Mm-hmm. Have you been getting a lot of calls to weigh in on people like me calling, people
yeah,
like my producer
it's,
calling?
It has. And then we were trying to get ahead of it after mm-hmm. Charleston. And it took us 6 months to come wrestle with an approach that we've been ever evolving because this continues to evolve. But we've talked with people from Dallas to Alexandria to Richmond, even Chicago, and all across the South. And University of Mississippi actually used our tool to contextualize their Confederate monument in the middle of their campus.
Wow. As we wrap up all of this, whether it goes back to Charleston or what happened in Charlottesville, in Virginia, the conversations about monuments, symbols, even street names, there seems to be a loss, though, when it comes to civil discourse. So if anything, it sounds like you're saying you hope people have a respectable dialogue about all of this.
Right. If we can talk about our history, our common histories, and let's talk about it in a factual manner. It's hard sometimes to agree on what the facts are, but let's listen to what people said.
Now, I have to ask you how, because I live near the Atlanta History Center. Y'all got a lot of construction going on over there, so I have to ask, what's the, give me an update, what's going on?
Well, the building for the cyclorama will be finished early in September. The painting restoration will take another year to do.
Really?
But it's hung, it's in great shape. We're very excited about it. The Texas locomotive is installed, and that should open in the spring. And we've got a lot on our plate, but it's really shaping up over there.
Did you have any idea what you all were getting into when you moved that cyclorama over there?
No, but I was so grateful when we rolled it, we unrolled it, and the paint was still on it.
Really?
I can't tell you.
Sheffield Hale, President and CEO of the Atlanta History Center. We've been talking about the center's Confederate Monument Interpretation Guide. And how can people access that again?
Go to the Atlanta History Center website, look under Research, Confederate Interpretation Guide.
Thank you so much for coming in and being a part of this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for WABE comes from the 31st Annual Marietta Art in the Park Festival, including work from more than 175 artists. No tickets needed for this family-friendly way to spend Labor Day weekend. ArtParkMarietta.com.
You're listening to Closer Look. If you missed any of today's conversation, catch up on our website at wabe.org/closerlook. Again, wabe.org/closerlook. Also, we want to hear from you. Send our host, Rose Scott, an email at rose@wabe.org. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
My name is Ann Nguyen, and I live in Stone Mountain. I like the shops. I like artists from there. I like the attractions and Stone Mountain Park. They have activities for kids. You know, they can practice and familiarize themselves with art, like pottery, painting. If I could change one thing about Stone Mountain, it would be traffic jam. It's really bad there.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We will bring you the latest on the effects of Tropical Storm Harvey on the hard-hit state of Texas. Plus, why did NASA scientists send balloons carrying packets of bacteria into the atmosphere during last week's total solar eclipse? What the Great American Eclipse might teach us about life on Mars. That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 3 on 90.1 WABE.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. We're going to continue our conversation. Heritage is history, and history is heritage, right? But when it comes to events and personas linked to the Civil War, the importance of preserving heritage, it's a platform for debate and, as we all know, protests. It's documented that days after Confederate General Robert E. Lee died, former slave and abolitionist Frederick Douglass stated, quote, "We can scarcely take up a newspaper that is not filled with nauseating flatteries of Lee, from which it would seem that the soldier who kills the most men in battle, even in a bad cause, is the greatest Christian and entitled to the highest place in heaven." Now that's from the Smithsonian Magazine special report, The Civil War, Making Sense of Robert E. Lee. It was penned by Arthur Roy Blount Jr. in 2003. The possible removal of the Robert E. Lee statue was the impetus behind a protest of white supremacists and nationalists, and then a day later spilled into a violent clash with anti-protesters. Now, we all know opinions about Confederate symbols and monuments. They've always varied. Even state lawmakers grappled with the Confederate design on the state flag and even license plates. Here's a history lesson for you. Finally, on May 8, 2003, then-Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue signed House Bill 380, officially creating a new state flag that had no likeness of the battle cross often associated with segregationists and even the KKK. We're going to continue our conversation now about symbols, symbolism, monuments, sculptures, even street signs. Joining me now in studio to offer their take on all of this is Andrea Knight, an Atlanta-based attorney who lives in the Grant Park neighborhood and lives on Confederate Avenue. She's organizing a petition to change the street's name. And Matt Turrell, an Atlanta-based artist and writer. Thank you both for coming in.
Well, thank you for having us.
I want to start by asking you this. When you see that old Confederate emblem, the battle cross, what comes to mind? Andrew, I'll start with you.
As of 2 years ago, Dylann Roof. That's what comes to my mind, first of all. And I think that was a big turning point for a lot of people. That's the first time we had, you know, we've always had conversations on the street about, isn't it strange that we live on Confederate Avenue? And the people who live there now are not the people who were envisioned to live there when the street was named. And, you know, you take it from that. And then after the Mother Emanuel shooting was the first time we had a really big push to come through and change that.
But prior to that, when you saw the battle cross and the Confederate emblem, I mean, we all, some of us, watched Dukes of Hazzard and saw, you never really thought about a connection, any other connection?
Oh, sure. I mean, definitely. But yeah. I think since then, all of those images of, you know, Bo and Luke riding around, mm-hmm. Leonard Skinner and the Klan and all of this mix of images, I mean, that picture of Dylann Roof was just so iconic. I think it replaced this sort of mix of images for a lot of people.
Matt, what about you? What did you see when you see that emblem?
When I see a symbol like the Confederate battle cross, I see the ways in which we can cling to our past, perhaps unhealthily so, and the ways in which the symbols of our past may linger on without us necessarily questioning their meaning and questioning why they are here. And when I see symbols like that, what I see is an opportunity to adapt and to change their meaning for the current context in which we live.
Now, if those symbols or a monument brings up, conjures up a time when folks were being lynched, a time of segregation. Can you understand that argument as well, Matt?
Absolutely. I think that symbols like Confederate monuments are oftentimes loaded with negative connotations of the past. And very often, for example, the Confederate monument of John Brown Gordon, which your previous speaker talked about at the Georgia Capitol, it's not necessarily about preserving a heritage or a past. It's about conveying power. And that conveyance of power is not always a good thing. And I think that we should be able to question, well, how can we change that? How can we alter that for our current political reality?
Matt, I want to stick with you for a moment because you emailed me, you reached out to me and you said, quote, speaking as an artist, my take on the Confederate monuments is that the conversation on fixing them is not very creative at all. I think calling for removing them is a missed opportunity to do something more creative and meaningful. And you went on to talk about an idea you had for some of these monuments and sculptures, and I want you to tell our audience about that.
So I'm here to present a third option that is somewhere in between leaving them as they are and tearing them down, which is to alter them. This is actually inspired by what they did in Eastern Bloc countries like Czechoslovakia and Hungary and Estonia after the fall of communism. They went in and they altered the old Soviet monuments as a means to disarm their power, change their meaning, to really move past what those symbols meant in their world. And I think that there's so much opportunity for the right monuments. I don't think this is necessarily right for all Confederate monuments. Alter them, to change them. I think that it is also perhaps a good way to really help us deal with them. We have state laws that prevent even the removal of these monuments, mm-hmm. but those same state laws say that we can reinterpret them.
Now, as an artist, and you're a sculptor, and a wonderful sculptor by that, I should add, how would you feel if someone wanted to alter your work?
Well,
because their interpretation was different from how you envision it or somebody else.
I think that you as an artist never own your work once it is out there in the world. the meaning of a work is never what you absolutely say it must be. The meaning of a work is what people take from it. And so if somebody wants to take my work and reinterpret it, if they have the right and the means to it, if they have the community approval to do it, go for it.
Andrea, you heard what Matt just said. What do you think about that? And we'll get to the street in a second, but I just want to get your opinion on what he just said.
You mean on reinterpreting rather than removing? Yeah. I mean, I think it does depend a lot on what monument you're talking about. I mean, it's certainly the Atlanta History Center, their context guide, I think that's wonderful that you come back and think about why was this statue put here and, you know, why is it here? I think that's wonderful, and I'm not an artist at all. I think very procedurally, so that's not something I would have thought about it at all.
Now, but you're also leading a petition to change the name of the street.
I am.
Why? You don't like Confederate
Well, I mean,
Avenue.
I think part of it is it started after the Charleston. Mm-hmm. It started then, and then we kind of picked it up. And then I think a lot of us sat around watching the coverage coming out of Charlottesville in horror. And that revived it. And people came back and were interested in doing it again. One reason is that there's not much room for context on a street sign. You know, what are you going to do with that? And it's interesting as we've gotten into it, we've got one of my neighbors on the street has done a lot of historic research on the area. So one of the reasons why people don't want to change it is Confederate Avenue is named for the Confederate Veterans Home. And when you start talking about, you know, 85-year-old penniless veterans of the Confederate War, you know, that's really different from talking about honoring Robert E. Lee. You know, so that's sort of a different thing. But that street wasn't renamed when the Soldiers' Home was built. It was renamed after the Atlanta Race Riot. So it is part of this, you know, this was actually a really important fact for a lot of people who live on the street, is was it part of this 1890s, you know, sort of push to take care of people who really couldn't take care of themselves? Or was it part of this, you know, exhibit of power? And
what's been the conversation in your neighborhood about this petition to change the name of the street?
I think it's been my perception, and maybe that I'll be corrected on that, but I think people really want to see that change made. I think for one thing, there are a lot of streets that you could drive on that might be named for someone you don't like, but you don't know that they're named for it, that person.
Well, there are streets and schools named after generals. There's Ashby, you know, there's, and there's Bedford, you know, so there's a lot.
But Confederate, you know.
Confederate,
every
right,
single
yeah.
person who drives down Confederate right. Avenue knows. And one of the people who came to our meeting on Friday talked about when she was, you know, now she lives in the area. She's very comfortable on Confederate Avenue. Not with the name, but, you know, on the street, she knows the people. But when she was 18 and had just moved to Atlanta and was a college freshman, she had a bad experience with the State Patrol. And when she found out that, you know, here she was kind of intimidated already and that she needed to go to Confederate Avenue to file that complaint against the State Patrol, just what an intimidating process that was for her.
And you propose changing it from Confederate to?
Well, I want to get resident input on it.
Okay.
But I will say at this point in time, my personal favorite name is Considerate. And so maybe that's not so different from what Matt's saying, because it is taking, you know, it's a two-letter change. And to me, that's a much better Southern heritage issue, is to be thoughtful of others, is much more consistent with my Southern upbringing than Confederate is.
So you're already seeing people putting stickers on those signs with SI to go ahead and sort of rogue change.
Now, y'all know that's illegal.
Yes, a little bit.
The rogue change got, by the way, in the neighborhood group, which gets like, you know, 40 to 100 likes on the picture. That one's at like 350.
Andre, I want to pick up on something that you said, because you mentioned my Southern upbringing. You're a racer in the South. You're from the South.
I am.
Matt, where are you from?
I'm from all over the South.
Oh, so Southern heritage. But we hear people talk about, look, this is part of Southern history, Southern heritage, why change it? Why not use these monuments or symbols or even a street to educate, to let people know what has happened in the past, because you can't change it. But if you try to change it just because you don't like it, then you're not really teaching, or you're not really accomplishing anything. I know you all have heard those arguments before.
We have. I feel like we've actually had a lot of really productive conversations in our community because we're talking about the street name change. So it's not just that the symbol changes overnight. There's all the conversations that are happening in the community about it. But I also say, like, I'm seventh generation Georgia, and I do have relatives who fought in the Civil War, but I had more who fought in the War of 1812. Where's their memorial? Why are we so fixated on this one little slot of history?
You know, we live with our past, both the good and the bad, as we continue to change personally and as a society. And I think that we owe it to ourselves to have our symbols, have our monuments reflect both the fact that we live with our past, but that we change and we continue to change and we want to change. We want to improve and become a better, more egalitarian society.
Can you understand someone listening and says, you know, Matt, I hear what you're saying, but you need to look through the lens of a person of color or a Jewish person when they see the swastika. And now, obviously, there are no monuments that I know of to Hitler anywhere in this nation. But can you understand someone saying, look through my lens and understand what this means? And I'm talking about sculptures now, what this sculpture, what this monument represents in a time where my heritage was basically enslaved, or, you know, the quality of life for me was nowhere near what it was for General Lee. Can you understand that?
I do understand that. And for that very reason, I think that there are plenty of Confederate monuments out there that should probably just be taken down. I think a good example of that is the obelisk in Decatur Square. That one to me seems to be just sort of like blatantly about a racist past. However, I think that there is opportunity with certain sculptures, for example, the John Brown Gordon one at the Capitol, to do something more powerful that speaks to a problematic past, that can speak to somebody who has, like an African-American person who has these scars on their soul. And how can we change the meaning of the John Brown Gordon sculpture? How can we take its power away to reflect the fact that this is a problematic person, a problematic monument? I think that there are all sorts of things that we could do. You know, in Eastern Europe, they've painted them to remove its power. They've allowed flowers to overgrow Soviet monuments. They've remounted things upside down to signify the problems of it. We're really only limited by our imagination of how we can change and reinterpret these things to reflect the broader picture here.
Yesterday was the unveiling of the statue of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on the Capitol grounds. What are your thoughts about that and the significance of that during this time when we're all having this conversation about monuments and symbols and all of that?
I mean, that was lovely. It was win for everybody. I mean, there was nobody unhappy that I know of who could have been unhappy about that. So that was a nice moment. But at the same time, you're putting that up and the Confederate monuments are still there.
I think that that really shows just how important this conversation is right now. The fact that that sculpture is right at the Capitol along with other sculptures that depict people who are, like, you know, going back to this John Brown Gordon, one of the founders of Georgia's Ku Klux Klan. The fact that those two monuments are staring each other down, I think we can make that area a better place by reinterpreting what the John Brown Gordon sculpture is.
Got about 30 seconds, but I want to get your opinions. What do we do with the carvings at Stone Mountain? You can't just cut that in half, Matt, and real quickly.
Grow kudzu over it.
Georgia performance standards. You got to change those before you can change much of anything else.
All right. Matt and Andrea, thank you so much for coming in and offering your opinions. I really appreciate it. That's it for today's show. Closer Look is produced by Candace Wheeler, Ebony Lemon, and Finley Fox. And our engineer is Elizabeth Eads. Our executive producer is Christine Dempsey. As always, we thank the WABE News team as well as our digital services crew, because if you head to wabe.org/closerlook, you can listen to our program, and you can catch Closer Look weeknights at 9 p.m. We're back tomorrow at 1 for another edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.